At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
It's a new day, but not just any day. Today is the first day of your apprenticeship, the one you were so nervous about starting. But you didn't let the fear of the unknown stop you. No. When potential came knocking, you not only welcomed it, you ran with it. Earning while learning on an apprenticeship designed with employers. All because you chose to make it happen.
It all starts with skills. See how you can get started. Search Skills for Life.
Hi guys, Pete and Abby from the Therapy Crouch podcast, and we're sponsored by Gemini, Google's personal AI assistant. Listen to this. Gemini, settle this debate. What's the ultimate relationship betrayal? Watching the next episode of your shared favorite TV series alone, or leaving them with all the washing up after a big dinner?
Okay, this is a tough one. Both are pretty bad, but I'd say watching a show without your partner is worse, at least with the dishes. You're not missing out on a shared experience.
I totally agree.
That's what I did last night. I watched 4 episodes without you. Sorry, it's the ultimate betrayal.
The time to me.
I know.
Gemini just said it's the ultimate betrayal.
It's the ultimate betrayal. I only did it last night.
Download the Gemini app today to unlock the power of Google AI on your phone.
True Crimers, welcome to Break the Case. I'm your host, I'm Jen Coffendaffer. Thank you for being here. We have a lot to unpack today. I want to concentrate on several areas, but we are going to go over the Idaho 4 case and specifically all the new, at least some of the new docs that have come out. I've been very closely covering them on my X account. If you want even more detail, you could go there. But we're certainly going to touch on it today. We have a great, a really amazing guest. His name is Philip Dubé, for those of you who haven't heard of him. He is a former attorney, both on the prosecutor side, on the government side, and a career public defender as well. Now, let me tell you why this is so important, at least from my view. This man has done the job. I really consider him very equivalent to me in the other side of things. He was on the legal side, prosecuting, defending, you know, individuals for the state in Los Angeles. And I was on the law enforcement side. So this is really, when he comes together on this platform, it's literally like a law and order, because I think we bring both things. And he walked the walk. I figured this out very early on in my discussions with him, because I would bring up situations with informants, with immunity, informations, just all the different sort of vernacular that you use. And he knew it all. Some others are maybe not as well equipped to know all those details because they just haven't walked that walk, right? They're more on the side of working personal injury or civil cases. But anyway, I just can't talk enough about the experience we're bringing. And besides that, he's actually really funny. I couldn't wear my black and white stripe that sometimes I like to wear when we're talking about guys that just got put to prison, like Brian Koberger, aka let me see if I can remember 631214, I think is his number. So I had to go with the mustard and black. Let's see if he has a joke about that because he was hilarious last time. He said I look like the guy in the Monopoly game. Anyway, here we go. Philip, how are you?
I'm groovy. How are you, Jennifer?
I'm doing great. Thank you for taking time today to meet with us.
Thank you back.
All right. Well, we're going to kick it off. I have a question about the documents. So as everybody has been seeing, Moscow PD has released hundreds of documents. It's taking forever to go through and to really piecemeal out the ones that are really important versus the ones that, you know, are routine and they aren't giving us any results or information. My question to you right off the bat is, Philip, Moscow came out and said, listen, we're going to give you what is from our department, but we're not giving you what Pennsylvania did. We're not giving you what the FBI did or state police, any of the other agencies. So everybody is sort of on their own. Just to let you know, from my perspective, it's ridiculous because whenever you are the lead agency, you have it all. So you better have it all. And if you don't have it all, there's a big snafu in the whole process. So why didn't they act as sort of the crew that the media can call on and people with FOIAs to send out that information? What's the legal reason?
Well, there are several. Number one, each state has its own sunshine laws, we call them, meaning that not every record is public record. And it varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction and from department to department. At the state, local, and federal level. If you take it upon yourself to individually release a federal record without the approval of that department or that department head, it could go criminal, frankly. Not to mention, you never know if there might be some order out there where everything has been impounded and held under seal. And if you don't get a court order allowing the release of the documents, you can be held in contempt. And that carries the pains of jail time. It's certainly not worth it. And then second of all, listen, the investigation was still ongoing. You don't ever show your hand when a case is not completely resolved. What does that mean? Well, until it goes to trial. You know, once the jury then sees the documents or hears what the contents of the discovery is, then it's public record at that point, and all sides have waived any privacy or confidentiality interest in most of the data. But until that point, because it's still under investigation, you don't want these sort of gumshoers, sleuthies, you know, wannabe Sherlock Holmes going out there doing their own private investigations, getting involved, perhaps even undermining and sabotaging the good police work without even having that intention at all. But that's ultimately what could happen. Finally, and this is just my opinion, there was tremendous outrage from the public in the state of Idaho that death was taken off the table for this plea deal. And sometimes the department heads, the agency heads have to do whatever it takes to kind of quell the angst, the fomenting going on in the jurisdiction. So what do? You kind of in piecemeal give them a bone. Well, what is that bone? Maybe some discovery, you know, maybe some of the gruesome details, the documents, just to calm the troops, you know, so you don't need a sergeant at arms and have to call in the forces to avoid a riot. But in general, I think those are the main reasons.
Great answer, Philip, because it makes a lot of sense. I know with the Bureau, though, when we work joint cases and as an example, disseminating discovery, we were always the lead, typically. The cases I was involved in, we were. And so we disseminated all those local records. But to your point, that's not to the public. That's not to sleuths, that's to other law enforcement or attorneys. So there's a huge distinction there. So thanks with helping us with that point. I want to go next to some of the items that are coming out. and we'll just hit them one by one. I have about six or seven that I want to touch on. First of all, I want to touch on, which for me was when all of this happened 2.5 years ago, and particularly when this search warrant came out, which showed the search warrant of his vehicle. And those items were listed. One of the items was a shovel. And I really kind of made a big deal about that on X. Anybody who follows me, I was like all into this shovel. And a lot of people said, well, maybe it was a snow shovel. Maybe he put it in his car to go, you know, 2,000, 3,000 miles, whatever it is, from Pullman all the way to Pennsylvania. Maybe that's, he needed a snow shovel. And my point was, no, I doubt it. I even ran a poll and it was about 73% said they don't have a shovel in their car when they go on a long trip, especially planning on returning. So now we know that in the shovel that was recovered, which we still don't have detail about that I've seen, there was dirt though. That's detail. No one uses a snow shovel. For those of you from the north, like I am, in Nebraska and Kansas, you don't use a snow shovel to dig a hole. So this was really telling to me. Now I have that question answered. And then they went and they actually used specimens from that dirt and compared it to the different places his digital evidence showed he was at. Obviously, they were looking for the knife. Philip, I just wanted to get your read on this as far as what do you think? Do you think they ever had a chance of really finding it in your experience?
It depends. There has been an evolving area of forensics called botanical DNA. I don't know exactly when it started in the United States, but I want to say that the genesis of it was somewhere in the state of Washington. And at issue was a homicide, and I believe it involved a child, where they were convinced that this particular defendant had done it, but they couldn't prove it until they got the bright idea to get into the undercarriage of the car and look for certain types of foliage, debris that could be unique to a certain terrain. And lo and behold, no pun intended, they hit pay dirt. They found a certain type of soil, leaves, and foliage that was unique to a very specific area in the region. And they went to that region, and lo and behold, after digging around, based on a trail of that specific type of botanical type DNA, they found the body. They actually found it. So my hunch is that shovel went to the lab. They may have even gathered specimens from the undercarriage of Brian's car to see if they can isolate down to a specific region where that DNA hailed from or where it was dug up, if you will. And then they could maybe go out and look in those particular areas. But it sounds to me that they really kind of left it as inconclusive, because I guarantee you we would have heard something that they either found the knife or maybe he buried the bloody clothes that he was wearing, the bloody gloves, the baklava or whatever the heck he was wearing, and everything else could have been buried in that specific area. But it sounds like in the end, it didn't pay dividends.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I know many people believe, and I'm curious to get your take, that he threw it in the Snake River, that he threw it in some body of water, because we all know that water destroys whatever it hits. You know, it's one of the greatest agents in that regard. And also the flow and so on and so forth. Many people get rid of evidence in water. From the very beginning of this case, though, I believed he would have buried it. And I said that and have stuck with that because I believe he wanted to go back to it. I think it would be something that even if it had been years, he could go back if things would have worked out his way and reminisce and look and feel that knife. That was just my belief. What's yours, Philip? Do you think he ditched it in some water or it's buried somewhere?
Oh, you know, given the fact that they did recover a shovel that had dirt on it, I'm convinced it's buried somewhere. Lord knows where. I don't think we'll ever know. And it sounds like maybe the soil sort of debris and remnants that were found on that shovel are not necessarily so unique that, I mean, basically you would need a drone to circle the entire state of Washington and maybe even Idaho to try to figure out down to a detail level where it could be. And you would need more than an army of search and rescue type botanists, if you will, to locate it. So I think they just sort of threw their hands up in the air and figured, well, if we can't figure it out on our own forensically, maybe when we go arrest him, we can get him to talk. And of course, he lawyered up and they never did find out where it is. But you never know. If it was buried, it could be that some hiker, you know, some construction developer might find it one day while doing construction, while tilling land somewhere, or maybe during a hike. So it remains to be seen if and when it will, in fact, be discovered. But for now, it's going to be a mystery.
Well, you know, Philip, one of the things that really just irritates me, and I think it irritates many people, of course, as you led from the beginning talking about the death penalty, the fact that he pled, there's no death penalty. He earned his life or didn't earn it. He bartered for his life. But I liked how Ted Bundy was handled. Again, a very strong case. He was convicted. And then during the time he was left on death row, all those years, a lot of people say, well, they're still in jail. But you know what? He kept trying to bargain for the death penalty to be taken off, even though he was sentenced. And he always held out hope for that. And he would meet with investigators and give clues about where other people were and talk about his crimes. And he was a plethora of information, although at some point they were tired of dealing with him and it was time for him to die. But my point is, by handling it this way, and this was one of the biggest reasons I was so bothered by it, is they did a plea, unlike what we do in the FBI. And they said, you don't have to say a word. You don't have to tell us anything. You don't have to debrief, nothing. In fact, you just need to say yes five times. The burglary is the one I'm including everybody is why there were five yeses. Philip, what do you think about this? Do you see why I'm irritated? Would you have handled this the same way? Tell us from an attorney perspective.
Well, from a defense standpoint, you want to give as little detail as possible. I mean, that's just my take on it, because there is absolutely no incentive for him to serve up any more information. The last thing that you want to have happen as a defense attorney is somehow drum up new charges. Remember, he was prosecuted in the state of Idaho. Who knows, maybe if the state of Washington could plan something, or the federal government. And the last thing that you want to do during a plea colloquy is invite more data, more facts, more information that could ultimately result in further charges. So no, you only answer what is asked of you. You answer the call of the question, no more, no less, and you get that plea accepted and you move on to sentencing and you let it go. There's an old expression in the defense bar, and we say less is more. And in this particular case, I think less really is more. And I'm not convinced that it's necessarily over for him, but for now it appears to be.
Okay, wait a minute. I'm going to flip the pancake now. There's two sides to every pancake. They look completely different for those of you who don't make pancakes. And you've talked about the defense pancake. I want to know about the prosecutor pancake because, and of course, as you know, because you've been in meetings for years, decades with law enforcement officers, we're always fighting to get these cases down the road. We don't like that a lot of prosecutors want a whale in a bucket is how we termed it in the FBI, meaning, you know, a whale in a bucket, right? Every single T crossed and I dotted. My question to you is as a prosecutor, do you think he did the right thing not, you know, pleading him out, not making it part of the deal for him to provide details? Or do you think that that would have been the deal breaker and they would have gone to trial?
No, I don't think it would have been a deal breaker. If I were in Ann Taylor's shoes, I would have still taken that deal because as negotiated, he was not going to get death. Her end game at that point was to get a mercy outcome where he would get life in prison. And she got that. And I think if the prosecution had insisted on more, getting more information, maybe even some type of a briefer allocution. I'm sure the defense would have gone along with it, even though it would have been against his legal interest. On a personal level, if it were me, I probably would have thrown in the towel and done it on behalf of the client, but certainly only with the client's consent. You always advise the client what the pros and cons are of doing it. And in the end, it is ultimately the client's decision whether or not to allocute. But remember, if they choose not to, and the prosecution is really flexing, then the offer's off the table and you start picking a jury. And now you are looking at the shooting squad. So if you really think about it, you don't really have much leverage, certainly not in the guilt phase. You might get one juror in the penalty phase who might put a little weight on his autism type problem, his Asperger's syndrome. But the practical reality of it is, I think we can all agree, it's not going to save his life. It's not going to carry the day. It's more of a counterfactual at this point. And I just don't think it's worth losing the life without parole disposition.
Yeah. I got to tell you, I see the defense side. The defense won. The Brian Koberger won. He doesn't mind being alone. I truly believe this. And I'm not saying this sarcastically or sardonically. This is a person who was a loner, a person who was on his devices, what was studying. You know, he had a very isolated life. He's going to continue to have an isolated life. Doesn't have to worry about working. Doesn't have to worry about money. The food isn't perfect, but I saw a lot of pictures of the plate, and the tacos honestly didn't look that bad. The bottom line is I think it was a win for Brian Koberger, bar none. What do you think?
Of course it was, because he lives to tell. Listen, make no mistake about it. Life is not going to be the good ship lollipop, if you will. It's going to be rough, okay? I mean, he's going to have a target on his back. He's going to be eating what I call the high fat, high sodium, high cholesterol, high fructose corn syrup prison fare. And we kiddingly sort of mocked the dietary fare in the public defender's office by calling it a judicially sanctioned culinary homicide. It's a slow kill, you know, because ultimately that's what it is. You try to live on that. In Yiddish, we call it dreck, okay? It is dreck. You do not get chicken on the bone. You might get some mystery meat and whatever that is, it's going to be full of sodium and take you out before the age of 50. If you're lucky. So no, the days of the bumblebee tuna fish, a sword filet mignon, those days are over. So yeah, it's going to be tough. You know, everything is going to be regulated, micromanaged, and cleared ahead of time for him. And he will have little to no decision-making authority as to how he lives his life. None whatsoever. He is literally just an inmate number living in a 6x9, you know, just sort of getting through the day, maybe getting a little sunlight and getting his crappy little meals. Maybe he'll get a postcard now and then. Maybe he'll get a visit from the family. But otherwise, it's going to be a very lonely existence. Now, to kind of piggyback onto that and going back to what you said, I think it's already a similar lifestyle to what he was already accustomed. And that means when many of the neurodiverse, I happen to have a brother who is on the spectrum, and people always say, why is this guy always talking about autism? Why does he think everybody's autistic? Why does he think everybody is on the spectrum? Because I actually lived with it and I saw the struggles growing up. And one of the classic symptoms of the Asperger's phenomenon is solitude. They do not like being in a room with other people, especially adults. They cannot meaningfully participate in adult conversations. They don't want to come off being, I don't know, unenlightened, ignorant, uninteresting. So they tend to leave the room and go inward. And maybe they play with their phone. They play video games. They watch TV. And some of them, frankly, they stare at the wall. They just don't have any social skills to speak of. And even when you do try to strike up a conversation with them, they go off topic and they start fixating on old topics that they're accustomed to and start getting into the minutiae and the detail of stuff that is way off topic and completely uninteresting to the group that you're with. So my point is, it's already a lifestyle to which he's accustomed. The only thing he's not going to have, obviously, are the same spatial relations, because he's going to be confined again to that 6x9 and having meals slid under the door.
Okay. I have a couple thoughts here. First of all, I know it's not Shangri-La, but he's going to be able, assuming he can afford it, which I think he's going to have money. I don't think there's going to be any issue with that. Look, there are more pro burgers, you know, people that are pro 163214 than you can shake a stick at. And they're going to be sending him money. They are going to be sending him letters. I wouldn't doubt, I've already predicted this, I could be wrong, but that he'll get married. There's no conjugal visits there, but I think he will get married. I think women will want to marry him. And I think that's going to happen. In addition, he's going to get a pad because he's going to be able to afford it. He's going to be able to use apps. He's going to be able to watch movies, watch TV. He's going to be fully integrated as long as he can afford it and can afford the internet time on a pad. So I don't agree with that at all, but I just wanted to paint the picture that although the mystery meat might be a downside, he is going to have an electronic device.
Yeah, he may. I'll be honest with you. I don't know exactly what the rules are in the state of Idaho, but I'm telling you, my gut says they don't allow it. It's just
they do
allow it. In some jurisdictions, they will not, because it can be viewed as contraband. You know, never mind having the iPad and going online and doing more bad things online and maybe even stalking people. But you might be able to dismantle the darn thing, shave it down and turn it into a shank. You know, and before you know it, you've got a custodial officer with a wedged weapon to their neck, you know. So that is one of the main reasons why a lot of jurisdictions will not allow it, you know. As for the phenomenon of people wanting to hook up, you know, like it's a dating app on, I don't know, Tinder or Grindr or one of those, you know, right? I mean, there is another phenomenon in forensics called hybristophilia. Hybristophilia is a true forensic phenomenon where people are genuinely aroused and attracted to criminals and killers. It's an actual known pathology where people sort of consciously seek it out. They don't act on it, but they actually seek it out. They foster tight relations with these inmates. They carry on relations even when they get paroled. And some of them do, in fact, stay married. Why? It's all part of that pathology, all of it. But usually what happens after the marriage and if they're released, it results in a divorce, because all along the inmate was just using that paramour, if you will, just for some type of avocational distraction to take their minds off the loneliness, off the solitude, and of course, the lousy prison fare, you know? And then before you know it, you're just sort of sidelined. And it's really sad. The other thing we've seen in California, I don't know if you've heard, we've had during conjugal visits where the mate gets murdered. You imagine? Oh, yeah. I think one of the major networks covered it, actually brought in next of kin family of these women who were murdered. You know, so the last thing you need is to go in, see your mate, see your soulmate. And the next thing you know, you're getting strangled, or maybe you're getting shanked with a makeshift knife that was carved out of an old iPad. Who needs it? Okay. That's the practical reality of it. Now, on the other hand, I can see how inmates do need mental stimulation. If giving them an iPad, a little access to TV and email kind of keeps the peace and the status quo, what's the harm? You know, if you feel that they're doing something nefarious, you can always suspend the privilege and they can never have it again.
Yeah, you're exactly right from the standpoint of that is why wardens really like this situation where they can have iPads and they can be entertained. Cable TV, one time I told this anecdote before, I was literally in line to go in to see an inmate in a Texas facility. And the cable guy was there. And I just said, oh, you know, are you going to fix the Warren's TV or what's happening? He said, oh, no, every inmate has a TV. They all have access. They even have the movie channels. I was obviously sickened because I was a brand new, you know, younger agent. And I saw the warden, of course, and I said, is this really true? He said, absolutely. He said, do you realize as long as they have television, they can pick their programming, I don't have fights. I don't have to deal with anything because they are so entertained, they don't bother the other inmates. And I think that's the whole point of these iPads, too. It's for this very reason.
Exactly. I've actually received letters from clients who I pled out, got them a good deal. And while they're in prison, they send me a letter. Mr. DeBay, I really appreciate what you've done, but you know, it's pretty dark and lonely here. Can you do me a favor and put some money on my books? I'd like to buy a thumb drive or some discs. And I write back and say, first of all, I'm not an ATM. Okay, number one. All right, number two, I do feel sorry for you and I understand your plight. But most important, they are not going to allow you to have a thumb drive in California or discs. He writes back and says, if you don't send me money for a thumb drive, I'm reporting you to the California State Bar. And I said, let me print out the forms. Okay, I'll get you a stamp. In fact, I'll even help you fill it out. What did your lawyer do wrong? He refused to buy me a thumb drive. He refused to do this. He refused. And I just send it in on their behalf because you know why? It gets closed out at intake. That's why. It's ridiculous. I mean, at some point, people expect too much in the end. Remember, they're just prisoners. They don't get to write the safety rules, the safety regulations. They have to follow what's before them. And if they don't, they're going to lose all privileges. And you know what else I've seen happen, Jennifer? They take away visitation. They can take it a step further where you are completely left isolated, all alone, just disconnected from society. No phone calls, no communication. It's done. You're on your own basically to rot away in prison. So you have to learn to respect authority and respect regulations.
All right. I'm going to switch gears and get into the really ugly part of the documents that have been released. And that is, and for those of you who, you know, would rather not hear this part, maybe put it on mute. Because I'm going to get into the details of the autopsy details, as well as the details of the police reports that have been released regarding what the Moscow officers first saw when they entered. This is why it's important to me. You know, they are still saying, meaning the prosecutor and at least one ISP detective, is that they don't know the motive, but some of the things I think used to determine that are how they were murdered, when they were murdered, who was murdered first. All of that, I think, does come into play. So in saying that, I'm going to keep it brief. Maddie Mogan, for the first time, we learned she had defensive wounds. I had never known that. It said that she had wounds to her forearm and to her hands. Those are indicative of defensive wounds. Also, she had some sort of gash or you know, trauma from the nose area clear over to the edge of the eye. That is very interesting to me. It became clear, I think, that she was stabbed first. Her primary issues were the stabs to her lungs and her liver. So just ruthless stabbing. You look at Kaylee, she was stabbed over 20 times, the reports say. She was hit by an object that they still haven't identified. I guess it had some sort of weird waffle pattern. The knife doesn't have a waffle pattern. Her hand doesn't. We know that she had sort of these gag marks, which I believed would have likely been used by his hand. But now that might not be accurate. We don't exactly know by the description. But her face, everyone, her face was unrecognizable. She was absolutely devoid of features anymore. She was beaten so, so badly. The other thing that I found interesting that we didn't know before is they were very close together. You know, we had heard reports that Kaylee was against the wall and Maddie was in the bed. Well, it turns out they were actually very close together to one another. And then, of course, that K-bar knife sheath was underneath Maddie partially. We also know Zanna 50 times. She was stabbed 50 times. And, of course, Philip, I think that's because a huge fight ensued. You know, I think she was more awake than everybody. She was headed to see what was wrong. The fight largely took place in the bedroom. We know now with all the blood that was everywhere, smeared blood, which, you know, I don't know whether that means she, you know, was moved and so blood smeared, or whether he took his hands, his gloved hands, and smeared it, but it was on the floor as well as on objects. We know a great deal of those marks were defensive. So I'm literally picturing that he's attacking her as she's like this. And that's why there were so many, so many horrible wounds. I think to kill Zanna took at least a couple of minutes. You know, when we really consider the amount of time he was in that house and how much time he spent with each one, I think that fight took the majority of the time compared to the other victims. And then Ethan, it would seem, was killed last. His neck area, his jugular was cut, Philip, as well as his arterial, or his subclavian artery and subclavian vein, which is just here right at the clavicle. Again, when people sleep, they're typically like this. So it makes a lot of sense. His head was found in between the bed and the wall. And his body was there. The other thing that was that I had never known was Zanna was face up. She was not on her side and she was not at the threshold. It said she was in the middle of the room. These are all real epiphanies, at least for those of us trying to put together and understand this crime scene. And again, my deepest apologies. I don't believe any of the victim families or Dylan or Bethany are on here or will ever listen to this. But for all of us who have followed this case, we're trying to put together the puzzle of what happened. And this is the intricate part of understanding that. Philip, do you have any comments?
Yeah. Well, first of all, it necessarily involves what I call a constellation of psychopathic behaviors. That's basically what it is. And you have somebody with a starting point of what we call the jar phenomenon, meaning jealousy, then it goes to anger, and then it goes to revenge or rage. He had in his mind, even though there is no forensic evidence or digital trail to support this, I believe all the forensic folks out there will support this idea that he had parasocial relationships with one or more people in that home, meaning in his mind. He never met him, didn't know him, but he romanticized and fantasized about, at a minimum, just being friendly and not so cut off and isolated. That was his starting point. But then when he felt being rebuffed, being rejected, maybe even had the cops called on him. Remember, there was some allusion to the fact that somebody was out front at that house and one of the girls came out, I think with golf clubs or something, had to call 911 because there was somebody creeping sort of in the gloaming, sort of, I don't know if they were stalking, but they were definitely there just sort of peering and watching from afar, and it scared the heck out of her. That could have been that tipping point where in his mind now he wants revenge. He wants to have the final word. But then you get that group of folks who think, no, this was all part and parcel of his grand plan to have the ideal criminology, PhD dissertation on, you know, maybe the perfect crime, how to get away with a crime, the unsolved crime, when in fact, all he did was, I don't know, hoist himself, if you will, with his own petard, as they say in Shakespeare, meaning he did himself in, you know? And what does that mean? Well, he left the darn sheath behind with basically his calling card on it, you know, his DNA profile. And that's what did him in. So he was sloppy in that regard. So, I do believe that this is a classic portrait of psychopathy. And it's really hard for ordinary, healthy minds to get into that type of mind and to understand it, and instead just call the guy Satan, call him demonic. You know, it's almost like vampirical, if you will, you know. But the question is why? And there really is no articulable reason why, only based on an analysis of the criminal mind and the psychopathy behind the high intelligence backdropped against the low emotional intelligence. And then you have this tipping point of being rebuffed and that it erupting, if you will, into this volcanic moment, this cataclysmic moment of revenge. And all along, it's in his mind. Nobody is actually rejecting him. Nobody is actually saying, hey, stay away from us. Nobody is actually saying to him, we don't want to be your friend. It's in his mind. And there is really no way to control that type of sick criminal mind other than to lock it up. I don't even think there's any known medicinal treatment for it. I'm not even sure there's any behavioral therapy for it at this point. All you can really do is put somebody like that in leg irons to keep the community safe. And unless and until you find some type of mechanism to control the behavior, you cannot let them out. Now, I will say, to be fair, if this is really all rooted in psychopathy, it's not his fault, you know? And I don't think that it's necessarily the type of impulse that he was physically and mentally able to control. Does that mean I condone it? Of course not. It just means he has to be removed from society to protect everyone. And that's what he got. In the end, he got removed from society and he will be gone for all time.
All right. I'm going to have to, on one of your points, two of your points, which I know you're just on one, recant or talking about what we've seen a lot of people think, and that is that this was some sort of experiment to see he could commit the perfect crime. I know that's not your philosophy. That's a philosophy some have put out there. And with all due respect for anybody who has that philosophy, I think that it is absolute buns, as we say on the tennis court. It's buns. It's not
in
worth
Yiddish,
it.
In Yiddish, we call it narishkeit, meaning it's foolish.
Yeah.
You know, it's foolish. Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense. Look, see if you can burglarize some place. See if you can, you know, do some other crime and get away with it. No, no, no. The passion, the rage to go in and do what he did to these beautiful young people is so far off the spectrum of normalcy. This is Bundy. This is rage. This is pinned up, you know, anger and ravage, you know, animalistic behavior. And so I just wanted to say that. Secondarily, to your point, something he couldn't control. I think a lot of people have issues with this. Just from my background and seeing people, they're the people that are the peeping Toms. That's how you start. People who like to mutilate or otherwise hurt animals and get a thrill from it. People who love to go in and burglarize and maybe take a pair of panties or maybe just take something, see if anybody notices. Stalkers. Mm-hmm. When I say stalkers, they don't want you to know they're there, but they're watching. Yeah. Those people have the same sort of issues. It's just they don't either have the courage or it never gets to the point where something breaks in their life, like what happened with Brian Koberger losing his job, his whole world crushing in, that they decide to take the next step. So I think people can control. But I agree with you. The only way to make sure they don't get out of control is to lock them up. Finally, sorry, real quick. The digital footprint regarding interaction with Kaylee or Maddie, because I think he may have, people don't like it when I say that because they've said law enforcement has said that there wasn't any, but they've also said he erased it all. or at least a huge part of it. We don't get to know what was done. All I can tell you is me personally sitting in Denver when I first found out who it was and started, you know, Twittering everybody. I looked at a profile. It was Instagram. And I saw that I think he was trying to follow Kaylee or Maddie or followed Kaylee or Maddie. And then all of a sudden, everything was gone. And Steve Gonsalves says the same thing. He says, listen, you know, they, I believe it was on IG. I'd have to ask him again, but that they were following. And I know law enforcement said they cannot confirm that. I agree they can't confirm it because it's white, but that didn't mean it didn't happen. Exactly. I am not an IG expert. But don't you think, Philip, that the fact that so much is gone leaves so many holes?
Not only that, he seemed to be eerily familiar with that property. How is it in such a short period of time, he knew the halls, the rooms, how to get in there, get out of there, who might be in there to be, you know, in the cover of darkness, wearing that balaclava mask, have that particular type of military knife? Why? Because it's obvious he knew what he was going to come across. He had some prior familiarity with that home, who live there, and what their hours of operation might be. So I just think it's, you don't even need an expert, a forensic guy, or a detective to tell you that. It's just common sense when you really stand back and look at it. I can look at it just from, based on my own lay observations and say, either this guy has been there before, or he's been staking out the place, or pacing, and, you know, checking out this property, and watching who's coming and going for the right moment to strike. And that's what he did in the middle of the night. He was ready to go.
Philip, you're so right. And he knew from actually doing papers about crime scenes, understanding about evidence, how evidence is looked for, what not to leave behind. He did a whole dissertation on it. Secondarily, I should say a paper. He did a whole paper on it. I've read it. Many of you have read it. In addition, he knew how to surveil. You know, he was taught that. He, for heaven's sakes, he was a PhD in criminology. You learn about surveillance techniques in undergrad. That's where I learned them. And then, of course, again, at FLETC and at Quantico. But my point is, when you're watching a building, who comes in, who comes out, what are their set patterns? People are habit forming, and they do the same thing. Just everybody in the audience or Philip, I mean, most of us have the same routine. We get up at approximately the same time and we do the same thing. Maybe not when you're retired as much, but certainly students have a very particular schedule. When they come in, they turn on particular lights. So you could say, okay, that blonde just went up to the third floor and that light went on. That must be her room. She got out of this car and she was driving. That's probably her car. All of these things, I totally agree with you. I also think he got a layout of the house, which was so easy. We saw it on, you know, one of the realtor top .com or whatever it was sites. You know, we saw that layout early on. He had access to that and he surveilled them. We know that from the information from the phones, but there's still so much we haven't seen, Philip.
Oh, yeah. And to be honest with you, I think there's more to come. I think as more and more discovery starts getting released and as each individual law enforcement agency so decides, I think more is going to get disseminated and available to the general public. And it kind of feeds into at least the true crime world's curiosity as to what went down. And hopefully it might answer a lot of questions for the families, because I think they have it in their head that somebody in that house, if not one or more, were specifically targeted. They want to know why. They want to know when it began. Was there anybody else involved? Was there another weapon involved? And maybe slowly and clue by clue and inferentially, they might be able to put more and more together as more documents are dropped. So in a way, it kind of, I don't want to say puts people's minds at ease, but it satisfies the curiosity and it takes pressure off the law enforcement agencies and the elected DA to give more answers, because now they're at the mercy themselves of each individual department to decide when it's appropriate to release everything. I, to be honest with you, I have seen attorneys get into trouble for releasing documents. You know, up until a couple of years ago, Jennifer, there was a law in the state of California that made it a misdemeanor for a lawyer to give a copy of a police report to his client. Can you believe that? If your client was out of custody, you could not give a copy of that report if it shows their name, address, and phone number. And I actually represented a young lawyer right out of school. He gets out of school. He went into criminal law, and one of the first cases he took on was domestic violence. Okay? He was representing a guy. And what happened? The police got a search warrant, and they went into that guy's apartment, who was on probation for domestic violence. They were looking for drugs. And what did they find? A copy of his police report on the coffee table. And they said to him, "Where did you get this?" He got it from his lawyer. The next thing we know, his lawyer is being frog marched into court, charged, you know, this is what happened. And let me just tell you, this is the one time I really love getting along with attorneys. I sat down with the city attorney's office and I got it dismissed, because it's one of those arcane laws that most judges don't even know exist. A lot of people don't even know you're not allowed to give your own client a copy of the police report. There's an ethical duty to keep your client apprised of what's going on in their case, show them the reports, let them know exactly what they're accused of. It's unfair, if you will, to criminalize the complete dissemination of the report to your client. Well, fortunately, a couple of years ago, they abrogated that statute. You're not allowed to file criminal charges anymore if you do that.
I want to ask you something, since you touched on attorneys. There was something that bothered me so much during, and I want to get into the victim impact statements a little bit. What really bothered me was, and I'm just going to throw it out there. We expected Brian Koberger, 631-214. We expected him to be stoic, emotionless, almost frozen, and he delivered. He was actually, for anyone to sit there for over 2 hours and almost not move and not have a facial expression, I challenge anyone to do that. It's really hard to do. Just to not speak for that long is hard for people to do. But what irritated me, and I know you were a defense attorney for years, a career defender, so the same position Ann Taylor had. Mm-hmm. What in the hell was going on with one defense attorney? Even got the smirkies, you know, the smiles, you know, at different times, and Ann Taylor not showing one bit of sadness that I could see. Did I see her put her head down? Yes. Did I see her? I mean, it was hard to have a dry eye, particularly during Dylan's and during Bethany's. I know Bethany's was said by another person, but it was Bethany's statement and it was delivered very emotionally. What the hell? I'm not even a cusser. Tell me with this.
Well, first of all, as to Brian.
Attorney? Okay.
As to Brian, let's start with him. Remember our starting point with him. He has those Marty Feldman bug eyes. You know, the classic neurodiverse. We see this sometimes in the Asperger's patients where they have a complete poverty of emotion. But really what's happening is they cannot process information that's coming in at the same rate that we can. They're not hearing it. They're not processing it properly. So instead, they're opening their eyes almost as if it's a port of entry so they can allow the data in. But to the outside world, he looks scary as hell. But the truth is, the eyes are almost like a separate receptor rather than the ears to receive, hear, and process the data. But again, to the outside world, he looks like he is really one scary SOB, you know, because it has that stone cold sort of thousand yard glare, if you will, where you wonder what is going on behind those vacant eyes, you know. And I truly believe it's a symptom of the ASD. I do. I will give him that. As for Ann Taylor, I find her to be a classy lady. I really loved her. I hope to meet her someday. I'd love to shake her hand, maybe even give the lady a hug and congratulate her for saving her client's life. Because let me tell you, she took it like a champ just sitting there. I've been there. I've had to sit in open court many times, being called a heretic, being called the Antichrist, all kinds of names for defending the person who took away a loved one. But you know what? You hold it all in. I'm a little disappointed, by the way, in Judge Hippler. I believe it's important to give a pre-admonition to everybody in court on the day of victim impact, not to trash defense counsel. And there was an attorney, I can't remember which one, who took to the lectern and basically kind of gave a dig to the defense team, you know, saying, look at them sitting there all suited up, you know, like as if they were in on it. They were, you know, co-conspirators to the underlying homicide. You know what? There are certain comments, certain remarks that are totally off limits. You got to let defense counsel do their job and not trash them like that for the world to see. That was disgraceful. I did not appreciate that at all, because I have been there where I've had to sit there and take it. And once in a while, you'll get a judge who steps in and says to even a victim, said, you know what? You're here to address the court about the impact that the crime committed by the defendant has had on you and your loved ones. Do not insult defense counsel. And I got to tell you, I really appreciate judges who do that and actually defend the representatives of these defendants. You know, as for the smirk, I got to tell you, Jennifer, you know, sometimes we're oblivious to the fact that cameras are in the courtroom. I cannot tell you how many times in outtakes you see women reaching behind, adjusting the clasp on a bra, you know, or how many times guys will reach down into their groin to fix themselves, you know, or how many times you catch people picking their nose, you know, just at the most unflattering moment. And, you know, we are not judged. We shouldn't be anyway by our worst moment. And if the camera happens to pan you at a vulnerable moment, you know, we're all human. I do not believe for 1 minute that she was not taking those proceedings seriously, but it caught her at an off moment where she happened to be doing something that was open to interpretation. I will give her the benefit of the doubt because I've been there. I cannot tell you how many times during victim impact, Jennifer, I'm fidgeting with my phone. I'm actually playing words with friends, trying to find a seven-letter word, you know, just to kind of get me through what's going on. I don't need to pay attention. The victims are there to address the court and to address the victims. But the last thing that I want is the perception that I am not taking the proceedings seriously or that I'm thumbing my nose or somehow flouting the court. I don't want that. And I've never met that defense attorney, but I'm sure she wasn't even aware that she was doing it. I'm convinced it was not her intent.
No, I this is why I love having you on, because we our lenses are from their different cameras.
Yeah.
And I love that because, you know, the fair thing to do is keep both sides in mind. But yeah. Philip, I want to say this for my part, because I have been pretty tough on Ann Taylor from the beginning, mostly because of a conflict. And I can't wait to see if there is an appeal filed, because remember, Judge Hippler said, because of Garza, and I want you to talk about that, that an appeal can be filed based on ineffective assistance of counsel. And I don't know if you were part of following this case this early on, but at the very beginning, there was a huge point that came to my attention and many people's attention. And I tell you, I went off on it. And it was a conflict of interest, because Ann Taylor / Ann Taylor's office had represented Zanna Kernodle's mother, Kara, and had also represented Maddie Mogan's father. And as you and I have discussed it on separate cases, when you're a I know the world of federal public defenders, okay. Certainly that's the fact. When you represent somebody that's a party to a case in that way, you cannot then represent the person accused of murdering their children, because there is a conflict. Ultimately, what happened, just to let you know, if you don't know, she was called into chambers by the previous judge, and she was asked, And what was your interaction? Because Kara Kernodle said, you know, she said she was my attorney. I'm uncomfortable with this. I can't believe she was my attorney representing me. Ann Taylor said, listen, I was not involved in that way. I was a federal public defender. I was in charge of federal, and I stood in sometimes, but she very much distanced herself from the interactions with Ben Mogan and Kara. Anyway, it kind of after she said, and there was a note we all got to see that essentially said there was no conflict and the judge ruled no conflict based on that conversation. So I was tough on her there. And then I was really, the other time I was really tough on her was her filing right up against what happened here with the plea, wanting a plea that four innocent people were involved in murdering these kids. This dissertation she wrote, trying to point the finger. And we saw what happened in the Karen Reed case. For a defense attorney to do that galled me. There are other ways to represent other than pointing the finger at innocent people. And thank God Judge Hippler said, we're not going to have any of this. These are unfounded. We're not going to do this. But she pushed for it. And if Judge Hippler would have maybe been Judge or Judge Canone, that could have been allowed. So I have such a huge issue with that. Tell me I'm wrong. You put me in my place.
No. It's okay. You know, remember, even though you are former law enforcement and an arm of law enforcement, you know, the cops are not attorneys. A lot of them really don't know a lot of the nuances of law. And I'm going to tell you the legal reason why Anne was not in legal conflict. It was not a legal conflict of interest. Here's the general rule. You cannot have concurrent representation of a criminal defendant and a witness in that case at the same time, meaning witnesses get into trouble. Witnesses get arrested, like let's say unrelated for shoplifting. You cannot represent that shoplifter and now this defendant if that witness is adverse to your client concurrently. But let's say in the past you represented shoplifter witness. Witness took a deal, pled out, case is closed. That witness is no longer a currently represented client. Well, what does that mean? It means you can represent the defendant now charged with murder. It's not a legal conflict. The only time that conflict could surface is if you want to pull the shoplifter's file and go through there and look for attorney-client privilege communications that you want to use against that witness at trial. That still holds the privilege. And if you want to use privileged information against a prior client in a current case, that's a conflict. You cannot compromise attorney-client privilege communications for the sake of a new client because you can't be loyal to both. On the one hand, you want to thoroughly cross-examine her at trial for this on behalf of your current client, but you don't want to give up your loyalty to the former client. That is a conflict. But if all you had was just representation, no notes taken, pled her out, took a deal, that is not a conflict. I'm not seeing it. You know,
the problem with it was, Philip, was that especially early on, and even now, because it's like I'm in the twilight zone, everybody just keeps coming up with these old theories that show Walter's guilty and all these other people, Dylan and everybody. But a lot of people were trying to point the finger at Kara and her, you know, the drug aspect of the whole thing and these families that, you know, whatever. They literally were trying to do that. And I was always concerned, and I don't know if we'll ever get to see who Ann Taylor said was part of those four people. But Philip, do you see where I'm coming at here?
Yes. I mean, the other point of displeasure that you had was her choice of defenses in the guilt phase, you know. And I got to tell you, as a defense attorney, I cannot worry about being socially or politically incorrect. You have a client to defend who's facing the firing squad. You're going to worry that somebody's feelings might be hurt out there because you're trying to manufacture a defense for your client. You're just going to have to get over it because you're not a party to these proceedings, okay? But what she did is she tried to work it up because she has a duty to in the guilt phase. But when she saw that all her defenses, you know, the alternate perpetrator, the alibi, and I don't know what other defenses she may have had, or maybe, I don't know, maybe she was going to put on some type of a mental health defense to say, look, that if he is autistic, he could not have formed the intent to kill. All right, fine. But when she saw she was losing on all of her defense fronts for the guilt phase, she realized her client was going down on four counts of murder. So column B is you work up mitigation to save your client's life. All she really wanted at that point was life without parole. The best she could hope for at that point was LWAP. And that's when she sat down with the defense team and her client and basically laid her cards out and said, look, I cannot win this. You are not going to walk away from this. We have to do something here to save your life. Please, I want you to think about it. Let me go speak to prosecutors and allow me to get you a life sentence. And he obviously gave her the green light. And that's when she opened up negotiations. And thank goodness that the prosecution was open to it. Because let me tell you, we get a lot of DAs out here who don't even want to hear about it. You got four deaths. You know, you can come crying to me in sackcloth and ash on bended knee with hat in hand. They don't want to hear it. Your client can take death or have a trial. That's how they'll deal with you, unfortunately. Now, on the other hand, we do get DAs who are very reasonable. And they'll say, look, because you're coming to us early enough in the proceedings, we haven't had to issue subpoenas, get everybody into court, spend all this money to get people from out of state, make all these arrangements. If your client wants to plead to the sheet, we call it, meaning to all charges, today only, he can have life without parole. And that's when you go back to your client and say, yay, we got what we wanted. We're going to advance the case, get back into court, and have Hippler take this plea and close this file out. And there's an old adage, I've said it many times, we say a closed file is a happy file. And he got what he, right? Come on, it is what it is. She's got another death case to move on to. She's a busy girl, you know? She's got other cases to deal with. She did God's work for him in that case and earned every nickel of her fee. God love her for it.
Well, Philip, that's definitely, I know from the an attorney standpoint, I totally see your vantage.
Yeah.
But from a law enforcement standpoint, this is how we feel.
That's why it's adversarial. You know, that's exactly
the case. We've done our job. We've done our job. We have worked the tireless nights. We have not slept for days. We're the ones that had to be in there with the blood and the guts and dealing with witnesses like Dylan and Bethany, who could probably barely speak and had to be interviewed Lord knows how many times, and we've done our work and, you know, 50, whatever it is, terabytes of information. Yeah. We've done everything. And guess what? Here we go. We've put this case on a flipping silver platter for you. You can imagine. And then, oh, a closed case is a happy case. And
To be fair, you won. You got your conviction.
My U.S. attorneys, do not tell me a closed case is a happy case. We just did all this. Why are we pleading him? You know, law enforcement never wants to see him plead.
Yeah, I understand. I do. But by the same token, I've had plenty of cops who've come out up to me after the plea and say, you know, thank goodness your client pled. You know, I've got a vacation planned with the family. The last thing I wanted to do was call Carnival to get a refund for this cruise. So I'd have to come in and testify. You know, I really appreciate the fact that your client really stepped up and took responsibility. Depends on how you look at it, you know? And I realize we make light of it because after all, it is a volume business and it's just another case. We don't get emotionally invested in it, oftentimes like the private bar does, because the private bar doesn't have nearly the volume of cases that we do. We do not allow ourselves to get emotionally invested in the cases, especially me. I look at it more cerebrally. I try to say, okay, what's the law? What's the evidence? What do they got? Should he plead next? That's how you do it. But if the client wants his trial, that's when you start fighting and you really work it up.
Yeah, I think for so many of us, we can just hear it resonating over and over again. Ann Taylor saying, "My client is innocent." And that's how she would say it. It was so dramatic. "He didn't do this. He's innocent. Oh my gosh, this is a trick." That is how she would talk, Philip. This wasn't one of those attorney situations that said, "You know, we're fighting, we're putting in our motions, we're making sure his constitutional rights are protected, we're going to give him a vigorous defense." This was theatrical, dramatic, that they had the wrong guy. And I think for a lot of people, that's hard to swallow. But I get your point, and I do appreciate you really bringing that side to it. You know, she saved his life. I do believe that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, and to be honest with you, most people, and I've said this time after time, they don't appreciate what we do on the defense end until they actually need a lawyer themselves. That's when you really start, or when you have family who needs a lawyer. Then suddenly we're doing God's work. They want to hug us. They want to send us gift certificates. They want to buy us trips to the Bahamas, whatever, you know, that's what they want to do to show their appreciation. You know, I remember years ago, I got a guy out of jail on a stupid driver's license offense. And a week later, I happened to be pumping gas and he was working behind the counter there as a cashier. He tried to give me a free tank of gas. And I said, no, I can't. I could get fired. No gifts, please. I appreciate it. I hope you're moving on with your life and you finally get a driver's license. You know, but my point is, though, that a lot of times it's just so unpalatable and unappetizing to the general public to see what we have to do. But just remember this, in the end, it's the client calling the shots. It's the client sort of navigating everybody's direction. If the client is saying, "No deals, I want a trial, you get busy, or I want your bar number and I'm reporting you to the bar." Then what do? You do your job and you keep working until the client's willing to throw in the towel and take the deal.
Well, Philip, if we ever do a show and you call Ann Taylor and get her to come on.
Oh, I would love to.
I will kindly and without remorse give my seat to her for you to interview.
I've never met her. But I bet she could be your best girlfriend. I'm really serious. I think you guys would hit it off, go golfing, play tennis together, you know, go bake cookies together, whatever, you know, baste a turkey, you know, frost a cake, you know.
I will say I love women, meaning yeah. I love to promote them. I think especially in the world of being an attorney, being in a doctor, being an FBI agent, those are areas that there's just fewer women.
Yeah.
And I love work. I have a lot of cases in the private, you know, my expert cases, and many of my attorneys now are women. And oh, they are phenomenal, you know, because I work both defense and prosecution now. They're phenomenal. But having said that, I just don't have it in me. I will not take a case that I don't believe in. Yeah. And, I just won't do it. And I don't have to do it now because yeah. I independently get to make those decisions. I don't have a supervisor telling me you're going to do this, but, and the Bureau doesn't do that anyway. I mean, nobody in the FBI is paid more to go after somebody they think is innocent. You just drop the case. Mm-hmm. But on the defense side, it's so much different because you have to represent people you know are guilty all the time. I think it's tough, Philip. I don't know how you do it. I do not know how Ann Taylor did it.
You know, it's interesting, but we, believe it or not, get a lot of wonderful, sweet people as clients who occasionally do bad things. A lot of it is rooted in addiction, mental yeah. illness, developmental disabilities, where they cannot control their impulses. So I understand that a lot of it is really not their fault. And people say, "Well, I have a nephew who's autistic. I have a niece who's schizophrenic. They don't do this stuff." Well, that's not how we package up the world and just sort of lump everybody together. Everybody is assessed and evaluated on an individual basis. Otherwise, if you think about it, everybody could ultimately have the same diagnosis. And everything has to be tailored to the person's needs. And sometimes, you know, you have to kind of think outside the box and not be judgmental about it. What can we do as a society, as members of not just the legal profession, but the healing arts, the forensic world, the psychopathy world, to try to help people so we can prevent these types of tragedies in the future? If all we do is judge, deny representation, deny treatment, you are never going to end the cycle of criminality. That's the problem. So unless and until you can set all that aside and have a stomach for it, you know, you should not be in the business. You know, it's kind of like the doctor who can't stand the sight of blood. You know, it's like, why did you go into medicine? You're telling me you can't look at blood? You're in the wrong profession, you know? And I've had many conversations with doctors where, you know, they have received patients in the emergency room where they were rival gang members spraying up a house who got hit in a hail of gunfire. They're brought in for life-saving measures. What, is the doctor supposed to not first do harm? Because they're in a gang? No, you set aside your bias against crime and against the offender and you save life. And we can talk about the social aspects after the fact. But in that moment in time, you put on your medical hat, or in that moment in time when I'm appointed, I put on my legal hat without judgment.
And my hat goes off to you. I did my very first internship with a defense attorney and I lasted about 4 hours.
That's okay.
We went to interview a guy who murdered somebody.
Okay.
Literally, it was a murder case. And I'm sitting there and we're going through it and we get in the car after the interview and I say, oh my God, he killed the guy.
Yeah.
I said, yeah, and we're gonna defend him. We're gonna make sure. And I said, you know, I'm so sorry. Okay. I'm gonna have to get an internship someplace else because this is not gonna work out for me. But I have a great deal of respect for people who do see that side of the coin from the lens you do, because we have to have people appropriately defended or else we risk innocent people going to prison. And believe me, there's a lot of cases, one that happened very recently that will always bother me, and that's the Delphi case. Mm-hmm. And another case that I need to spend more time on. You and I should do a show on Delphi and on another case I want to bring to your attention. The other case particularly, oh my gosh, that kid is so innocent in my belief. But anyway, I thank you for the service you gave and that there's people to represent defendants. But I'm telling you, Brian Koberger didn't just make a mistake. He is a cold-blooded, vicious murderer.
Yes. Yes. Legally now, too.
Legally now, too. Philip, thank you for spending, I said 30 minutes. I think we're at like an hour and something. I am so sorry.
That's good. No worries.
Great conversation. Everybody in the audience, thank you. I hope you liked, and what do they say? Like and subscribe. I never really ever say that, but like and subscribe. And we appreciate your time coming in and being part of chat and being part of the community, and to the mods who try to keep the crazies out. And I don't even mind the crazies in. And I always tell the mods, listen, as long as they're not just throwing out names and just being completely disrespectful or hateful or threatening, let everybody have a voice. So thanks again, Philip. I am going to have you
very welcome
the show. You're the best.
Thank you much.
Oh my gosh, guys, isn't Philip the best? I tell you, I might have to have a conversation with him about doing more shows, because I really appreciate him having, in a sense, a lot of some opposite views of me, but being able to just discuss. And I have the utmost respect for him and for anybody who does the job he does, because he does it for the right reasons. He really does value justice being served. And I bet he was very good in a courtroom and probably outside of a courtroom, making sure that cases that should never go to a courtroom get there. Everybody, thank you so much. This has been really great. As more documents come out, you're going to see me address them on Twitter as they come out. And then I'll do a show probably once a week on Koberger. The other thing we're changing is on Fridays now, we're going to release more of a Dateline version of the show where we're going to pre-record it and include photographs and maybe even clips and things like that. I have hired somebody to assist with that, just trying to really dig in and put a little bit more time toward the podcast, because I appreciate every member. There was someone who donated a membership. I want to thank them so much. And I hope you all become members. And I appreciate each and every one of you. Till next time, may justice be served.
Potential. Potential can sometimes feel daunting, scary. But today's the day you decide to act on it with a higher technical qualification. Designed with employers, it will give you the skills you need to land the job you want, because today is your day. When anything is possible, if you make it happen.
It all starts with skills. See how you can get started. Search Skills for Life.